Your home here at the O'Day Pod. We simply sit with God's amazing word, unpack it in everyday language, discover what it looks like to walk it out every day, and then surround it with amazing music. Like a warm hug from heaven, wherever this finds you, rushing to work, prepping dinner, or finally chilling out. My hope is that God's word meets you in that exact moment, just as you are. And now let's head into today's deep dive.
Welcome to today's deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
So if you're joining us, you are really in for an incredibly profound journey today. We have a fascinating stack of sources to explore for you.
We really do.
On one side, we have this really rich, incredibly detailed theological commentary.
Very dense.
Right, very dense. And on the other side, balancing it out, we have a piece of evocative, poetic music lyrics. And what's amazing is that both of these sources, even though they're in entirely different mediums, they're exploring the exact same ancient and frankly mind-bending concept, which is the word.
It's a concept that has completely shaped centuries of thought.
It really has.
And our mission today is to look at the very architecture of reality through that specific lens. You know, looking at how both the scholars on one hand and the poets on the other try to wrap their heads around it.
And to make sure we don't get lost in the weeds here, because we're setting some strict parameters for this deep dive.
It's definitely necessary.
Yeah. We are focusing uniquely on two massive foundational ideas from these sources. First, we're looking at the eternal deity of the Word before creation.
Which builds the absolute foundation for the Trinity.
Exactly. And second, we're going to look at the Word as the active agent through whom absolutely everything in the universe was made.
It's a huge agenda. I mean, we're essentially looking at the blueprints of existence before time even began.
Right.
And then watching how those blueprints became our physical reality. It's ambitious, but the sources we're working with synthesize this perfectly.
So whether you are a theology buff who loves getting into the original Greek,
or just someone deeply fascinated by how ancient texts explain the origins of the universe, you know, and meaning itself,
this deep dive promises some profound aha moments for you. So, okay, let's unpack this. Our theological source kicks things off with the opening of John's gospel, which centers on the Greek term logos. Now, that usually gets translated into English just as word, but our text points out that logos carries a much richer, heavier meaning than just, you know, a unit of spoken language.
Right? Oh, absolutely. To the ancient mind, logos wasn't just a grammatical term.
Yeah.
It meant divine expression, reason, personal revelation. It was literally the organizing principle of the universe.
Wow.
So when the text says, "In the beginning was the Word," it's deliberately echoing the very first words of the Bible in Genesis.
Right, Genesis 1.
But it's actually pushing you to look even further back.
How so?
Well, Genesis starts with the creation of the universe, but John's gospel starts before there was a universe to create.
Wait, so if we're looking at the state of things before the universe existed, how do we even wrap our minds around that? I mean, how does the text describe what the word actually is in that state?
The scholars who put our source material together break down those first two verses of John chapter 1, and they pull out three vital truths about this logos. The first one is eternal existence. And this hinges on the original Greek word used for was, which is en.
En.
Right. En. This is crucial because en does not mean the word came into being at a certain point. It means the word continually, already, always was.
So no starting point.
Exactly. The word never had a beginning.
That immediately bends the mind. Just the idea of something existing without a starting point. We're so conditioned to think in terms of cause and effect, you know.
Yeah.
Everything have a birthday.
Right. But the text is forcing us outside of time entirely. But the second truth brings this abstract idea into a much sharper focus.
Which is?
Distinct personhood. The passage says the word was with God. And the Greek phrase used here is pros ton theon.
Let's hover on that for a second. With God. Does that just mean they were existing in the same general cosmic vicinity?
Not at all. And that's where the nuance of pros ton theon is so beautiful. It doesn't mean proximity. It implies an intimate face-to-face fellowship.
Face-to-face.
Yes. It denotes a relationship. The word isn't just floating nearby. The word is actively engaged in eternal fellowship.
Okay.
And then the third truth completely locks the picture in place. Full deity.
Right.
The passage explicitly states the word was God. It's not describing a lesser being. It's not some divine spark or an emanation. It is co-equal and co-eternal with the Father.
Hold on. So if the word is God, but the word is also face to face with God,
Yeah.
how does that not just mean there are two gods? How do our sources reconcile that tension?
What's fascinating here is how these three truths, eternal existence, distinct personhood, and full deity, synthesize to form the essential foundation of the Trinity.
Okay.
The sources point out that the word is not some abstract impersonal force like gravity or karma.
Right, it's personal.
The word is a person, and this person has never, ever been separate from God in essence. They share the exact same divine nature entirely, yet at the exact same time, the word has always been relationally distinct.
So same in essence, distinct in person.
Exactly.
I know the early church spent centuries arguing about this. Our source text actually mentions that this specific phrasing in John was meant to shut down some pretty massive debates.
Oh, completely. The text notes that this specific phrasing deliberately refutes two major historical misunderstandings. First, it completely dismantles Arianism.
Arianism.
Yeah, which was the idea that Christ was essentially the first and greatest created being.
Like a super angel.
Exactly, a lesser deity. But John's use of "and that eternal was," and the direct statement that he was God, shuts that down completely. He always existed.
Right, because if he was created, he'd have a starting point, which violates the whole concept of "and."
Precisely. And the second idea it refutes is Sabellianism.
Which is what?
That's the idea that God is just one single person who simply puts on different masks or plays different roles at different times in history.
Oh, I see.
Like sometimes acting as the Father, sometimes as the Son. But the phrase pros tenemi on that face-to-face fellowship proves that wrong.
Right. You can't have face-to-face fellowship with yourself.
Exactly. The word was relationally distinct, enjoying eternal, perfect fellowship with the Father.
It's a beautifully complex picture of the divine. And what I really appreciate is how the lyrical source we have captures this immense eternal reality in such a hauntingly personal way.
It really does.
When theology gets this dense, sometimes you need poetry to make it land.
Definitely.
The lyrics in our stack say, in the beginning, before the sound, before the sky, there you were, pure presence, every breath still in your mind.
That is such a stunning way to describe pros tenion. Pure presence before the sound and the sky even existed.
Yeah.
It frames the Trinity not just as a theological equation that we have to solve, but as an eternal relationship of pure fellowship that predates the entire universe.
Wow.
It means that love and relationship existed before there was even a universe to contain them.
But that brings up a huge question. If the word existed perfectly content in this face-to-face relationship with God,
why make anything at all?
Exactly. How do we get from that silent, eternal presence to the loud, physical universe we live in today?
That is the big shift. We're moving from the word's eternal state of being to the word's action of doing.
Okay.
Verse 3 of our text says that all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made.
That is an incredibly sweeping statement. Absolutely everything.
And our theological research highlights a brilliant linguistic contrast in the text here that makes this point undeniable.
Let's hear it.
We just spent all this time talking about the Greek word and the eternal ongoing was of the word. But when the text shifts to creation, it uses a completely different Greek verb, egeneta.
Egeneta.
And egeneto translates to were made or came into being.
So there's a linguistic firewall between the word and literally everything else.
Exactly. Everything in creation has an egeneto, a definite starting point, a moment it came into existence.
Right.
But the word has only an eternal existence. The word is like a continuous line stretching infinitely in both directions, while creation is a dot that suddenly appears on the page. Everything created had a beginning, while the word did not.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The text emphasizes the absolute exhaustive nature of this claim. It says nothing exists apart from his creative power.
Nothing.
The word stands completely outside the category of created things. If a thing exists and is not God, it was made by the word.
That is the ultimate definition of the uncreated creator. It excludes any possibility that the word himself could be a created being, hitting back at that Arianism idea again.
Right.
The word is the active agent of creation. In Genesis 1, we read that God speaks the universe into existence, but now we're being told that the speech itself, the logos, is a distinct divine person actively doing the crafting.
The lyrics in our source material hit on this staggering truth so perfectly. They say, all that spoken, every star that learned to shine came from someone more than space, more than time.
I love that line.
I just can't get over that phrase. Every star that learned to shine, it personifies the creation, almost like it's responding directly to its creator.
It's beautiful, and it connects this massive cosmic theology right back to your everyday experience as a listener.
How so?
Think about that for a moment. When you look up at the night sky and see the stars, or when you look at the intricate complexity of a river ecosystem, or even just consider the beating of your own heart,
yeah.
You're not just looking at random cosmic accidents. You're looking at the direct craftsmanship of this eternal word. You're seeing the work of someone who is, as the song says, more than space, more than time.
It completely changes how you view the physical world around you.
Mm-hmm.
The universe isn't just a machine. It's a spoken reality.
Precisely.
But the text doesn't just stop at physical creation.
Yeah.
It pushes deeper into the nature of what was actually created.
Yes, moving into verses 4 and 5.
Right, where it talks about life and light. In him was life, and the life was the light of men.
And our sources really dig into two key Greek terms here that we have to understand. Zoe for life and phes for light.
Let's start with Zoe.
The research explains that this life resides inherently in the word. It's not derived from anywhere else. Think about everything else in the universe. Our life is entirely derived.
Right.
We need oxygen, we need water, we need sunlight, we need food. Our life is incredibly fragile and dependent.
We're constantly consuming things just to stay alive. But the word's life is entirely independent.
Right.
The word doesn't need to consume anything to exist.
Exactly. The word is life. And this represents both physical life, because he's the active creator of all biology, but more profoundly, it represents spiritual and eternal life.
Very life that God possesses.
And imparts to us. And that life, the text says, is the force, the light of men. It's the one true light that illuminates truth, holiness, and the knowledge of God for humanity.
And there's a grammatical point made in our notes about the definite article there, too. It's the light.
Not a light.
Right. It's not a light among many options. It excludes all counterfeit sources of truth in what is essentially a morally dark world.
And that introduces the great conflict of this entire passage. You have this absolute pure light, and it enters into a world that pushes back. There's an ongoing battle.
Yeah. Verse 5 says, the light shines in the darkness.
Notice the present tense, shines. It's a continuous, unyielding action. The light has never stopped shining against the darkness.
And the darkness here isn't just an absence of light, right? It represents sin, spiritual blindness, the active opposition to God.
Yes, and the text says the darkness has not overcome it. The theological commentary dives deep into the Greek verb used for overcome, which is katalambano.
Katalambano.
Now, this is a tricky word because it can sometimes mean to comprehend or to understand. But our source argues that the context here heavily favors overcome or extinguish.
So it's not just that the darkness doesn't understand the light. It's like the darkness is actively trying to snuff out a flame.
Yes.
It's a wrestling match.
That's the perfect way to visualize it. It paints a picture of fierce opposition. The darkness is not passive. It actively resists, fights, and tries to smother the light.
Wow.
The scholars note that this cosmic conflict culminates at the cross. That was the darkness trying its absolute hardest to catalambano, to extinguish the light.
But it failed.
Entirely. The darkness has never succeeded, and it never will. The resurrection is the ultimate proof that the darkness could not overpower the inherent Zoe of the word.
That is such an empowering thought. The light is literally invincible.
That is.
The lyrics we're looking at echo this ongoing battle and the ultimate victory of the light so well. They say, darkness trembled at your whisper, shadows scattered at your name.
Such powerful imagery.
And later on, they sing, breaking through the deepest night, every shadow meets this light. It really captures that unstoppable, penetrating quality of the Logos.
It gives anyone reading this an unshakable confidence. No matter how fierce the spiritual blindness or opposition gets in the world, or even in our own lives, that catalambano, that extinguishing force, simply cannot succeed against the inherent uncreated life of the Creator. It's a physical and spiritual impossibility.
Which brings us to what might be the absolute climax of our entire stack of sources. We've talked about the eternal word existing before time. We've talked about the word creating the entire cosmos.
The aginato.
Right, and sustaining invincible life and light against the darkness.
Yeah.
But then we hit John 1.14, and this is the great paradox.
And the word became flesh and dwelt among us.
The uncreated creator, the one who spoke the galaxies into existence, steps directly into the creation. It is staggering to even think about.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really is the ultimate plot twist of human history. The eternal word didn't just appear human as some sort of illusion or hologram.
No.
The text stresses that he truly became flesh. He assumed full physical humanity without ever ceasing to be fully God. And the verb used for dwelt here is incredibly rich. It's eschinosin.
Eschinosin. Yeah. I know this is a word that theologians get incredibly excited about. Why is that specific word so important?
Because it literally translates to tabernacled or pitched his tent.
Oh.
And this is a massive, deliberate callback to the Old Testament. If you think back to Jewish history, the tabernacle and later the temple was the specific physical place where God's intense, holy presence dwelt among his people. It was called the Shekinah glory.
And that wasn't a subtle thing. When we read about the Shekinah glory in the desert, we're talking about pillars of fire, blinding clouds of smoke, a presence so intense that people were terrified to go near it.
Exactly.
That was God pitching a tent with the Israelites.
It was visually and physically overwhelming. But now John is saying that this exact same intense divine glory is perfectly revealed, but it is veiled in human flesh.
Wow.
The word pitched a human tent among us.
Tabernacling in the dust. The contract is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Going from a pillar of fire to a physical, vulnerable human body that gets hungry and tired.
Yes. And the passage goes on to say, we have seen his glory, glory as of the only son from the father. The scholars highlight the term for only son, which is monogenes.
Monogenes.
It means unique, one of a kind, beloved. There is literally no one else like him because no one else is the eternal, uncreated God wrapped in a physical body.
And our source points out that he is specifically described as being full of grace and truth.
Yeah.
Why those two specific words?
This is another brilliant Old Testament connection. The text links this directly to Exodus 34.6, which is the moment where God describes his own character to Moses.
On Mount Sinai.
Right. He describes himself as abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. In Jesus, that covenant mercy, which is grace, and that absolute faithfulness, which is truth, meet perfectly.
They come together.
He is the ultimate living revelation of the Father's character walking around in the physical world. You don't have to guess what God is like. You just look at the Word made flesh.
I love how the musical source grounds all of this high, lofty theology in gritty physical reality. It beautifully weaves together everything we've talked about, bringing it down from the cosmos into the dirt.
It's very grounding.
The lyrics say. And the word became flesh.
Yeah.
And he walked here among us full of favor, full of truth in the middle of our dust. And then it builds this incredible defining line. Glory wrapped in weakness, calling every child by name.
Glory wrapped in weakness. That summarizes the incarnation flawlessly. The one who possesses that infinite end. Who stood face to face in the Trinity, who spoke the stars into existence, who holds invincible life and light.
He deliberately chose the weakness of a human body.
Exactly. He chose the limitations of space and time and the grit of our dusty reality.
So what does this all mean? Let's recap the incredible journey we have been on in this deep dive.
It's been quite a journey.
We started entirely outside of time, looking at the intimate, face-to-face fellowship of the Trinity before the universe even existed. The eternal logos.
Right.
Then we witness the staggering active power of that word, speaking stars into existence and serving as the uncreated creator of everything that is.
The genito.
Yes. We saw that word as the invincible light pushing back a darkness that frantically tries to extinguish it. And finally, we follow that infinite power all the way down to the ultimate humility, the creator pitching a human tent in the dust of human sorrow and weakness, perfectly full of grace and truth.
It is a breathtaking arc from eternity past to the dirt of first century Israel.
It really is. And this raises an important question for you listening right now.
Yeah, let's bring it back to the listener.
We spent all this time talking about the cosmic scale of the Word. But if the eternal uncreated Word, the very foundation of reason, light, and life in the entire universe, chose to deliberately wrap that boundless glory in human weakness and step into our ordinary dust.
How does that change the way you view these seemingly mundane, messy, or difficult moments of your own daily life?
Exactly.
Is it possible that the deepest divine truths are waiting to be found not just out in the cosmos or in ancient Greek texts, but right in the middle of your everyday reality?
That is a brilliant thought to carry with you.
Right.
When you are doing the dishes or sitting in traffic or dealing with the grit of just being human, you are the exact same dust that the uncreated creator chose to tabernacle in.
Beautifully said.
Thank you for joining us as we explored the profound depths of the eternal word. We hope this deep dive has given you a richer, more expansive view of the architecture of reality. Until next time.
Thank you for being part of the O'Day Pod family today. I pray that God's word and our discussion have left you feeling truly enlightened. We'd love to see you again next episode. Until then, here's the featured song from today's show.
In the beginning, before the sound, before the sky, there you were. Pure presence, every breath still in your mind. All that spoken, every star that learned to shine, came from someone. More than space, more than time.
Darkness trembles.